I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
The street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight.
Suzanne getting naked, and in Suzanne's story, getting naked, it was all about hiding herself for more than 50 years. An amazing surgical procedure now allows the courageous New Yorker to show her true face, an inspiring role model for those with disfiguring birthmarks and all of us who simply long to be accepted and to fit in. Susan, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I think your story in and of itself probably describes 70 to 80% of the population out there, even if they don't have a literal birthmark or some kind of a scar or something, but maybe inside also that you have to move through it. Now, let's go back with you in life. You were taught to hide yourself, to cover the 6-inch port wine stain that dominated nearly the entire left side of your face. How did you deal with it in school, and did you deal with it the way you were comfortable with it or the way you were told to deal with it?
Well, that's an excellent question, Michael. I think I adapted well, and since I wore makeup literally since I could sit up, I didn't know anything different other than nobody else got to do it except me, and I was the only one. There was a great sense of independence and an accomplishment when I could put my own makeup on at the age of 4.
Sure.
But I knew I was different and fitting in. It's like wearing a mask every day and the bugs got stuck on my face. And it was uncomfortable, and I always thought people were staring at me. So
yeah.
I really tried to hide myself from
the birthmark itself. Where did that come from? Did anybody else in the family have it? How did you get it?
Well, it's not something that you get, and it's not inherited, and it's not infectious. It's just one of those gifts that God gives you when you're born. And it's a defect in your blood vessels, and actually what happens is your blood is pumped to the outer surface of your skin. Normally, it stops underneath your skin, and it doesn't come up. So with me and the port wine stain that I have, and other people who have port wine stain, the blood is pumped to the surface. So that blood now is red because of... And second of all, what you've got is the weight of the blood causes... So it's uncomfortable, Michael.
I can imagine it would be, and then trying to hide it, wearing the makeup, and then again, if something happened, if you got caught in the wind, if you sweat, if you did something, the makeup would go, and then it would show. And that,
well,
I imagine, yeah, go ahead.
It's hard. I mean, if you put your hand over your left eye and along the side to the bottom of your mouth, imagine that being bright red. Or the color of wine. If people saw that, they would stare at you. Instead, they saw a China doll, a little girl with makeup on, which you'd look at her, isn't that strange? But it was better than people seeing what I really look like, because then they would be scared of me. And then they wouldn't have anything to do with me.
But you did meet someone and you did get married. Did he see that, or did he see through that originally? I know you got divorced.
Well, you know, it's funny you said that, because my grandmother was very concerned, and she pulled me aside and she asked me, did he see you? And I said, you mean what I really look like? And she said, yes, and he wants to wake up to that? And I said, yeah, believe it or not, he does. Yes, he did know I had a port wine stain, and yes, he was the one that introduced me to the doctor. But I don't think that was ever our problem. I think one has other problems that we hide through marriage that I didn't allow him to see me. There came a point in my marriage I never wanted him to see me without makeup because I never felt safe enough. And that's a relationship.
You know, a very interesting point. Not to feel safe enough. And it's a reversal of what anybody would think. You know, you feel safe because you're hiding, you've got the mask on. But to take the mask off and to be vulnerable, that's not safe. And to wake up in the morning, you don't see a face. You're going to see who you're in love with or you're not in love with. And I really believe truly that your grandmother didn't see it in any way, shape, or form, or to any degree.
I don't think a lot of people got it because they're more worried about what the external is rather than the internal.
Sure.
And I think we're all worried because as much as you protect somebody, the fact that I was never going to be pretty was the reality I lived with. Some people never live with who they are, and I accepted who I was at a very young age. And it's an excellent point you're making, because once you feel good about yourself, and the first time I had surgery, this laser surgery, it didn't remove it, but it changed me in how I felt about myself because my face was not an issue in my mind anymore.
Suzanne, I think there's a complete difference in the definition of between pretty and beautiful. And pretty is outside. Beautiful is inside, and then it externalizes.
Correct. But it is hard to explain that to a 20-year-old. And
sure.
It's hard to explain that to a 30-year-old. But when you reach my age at this point, the true beauty of a person is all about the insides and who they are and how they are. And the external has nothing to do with it.
No, absolutely. But the people that you can touch, the people you can reach, the people you can teach, those people that, and even the 20, the 30-year-olds now that have that problem, whatever that problem is, to whatever degree that they have it, if they can understand one of two things. One is the people who truly accept you for who you are inside. And the other side of that is they can define really what beauty is. And if they want to go for the beauty, if they want to go for what's inside, then that's who you want to keep around you. The other ones you don't want to keep around you, and I think it's a great message.
It is, and it's so hard for all of us to find the right people to be safe in how we develop and what changes who we are, and just by being afraid of someone's reaction to an outside appearance.
Okay, so you tried various things, didn't seem to work. And then you found, and stop me if I'm mispronouncing his name, but Dr. Roy Geronimus. Did I get it?
You got it perfectly.
Okay.
Dr. Geronimus is one of the leading pioneers in laser surgery, and he's been doing it for since I've been doing it, 1987. It's the only procedure I've ever had done on my face, the only doctor I trusted to touch my face. Before him, I covered my face every day with makeup so it would not be seen, which had its benefits because it didn't get touched by the sun either. Dr. Geronimus has been doing laser surgery, and over the years it has gone through basically, I believe, three different generations of technology, and the current technology of the laser has now removed my stain, which is huge.
It's got to be very interesting to wake up in the morning and look in the mirror. Do you look at yourself and you say, who is that?
Well, it's been very difficult for me, Michael, because I don't know who I am. You dream of being a certain way because you hate putting makeup on every single day. And now I don't have to do any of those things, and I can jump out of bed and throw clothes on and go outside. I'm not used to that. That's new behavior for me. So now I have to get used to being normal, which has been very exciting, but it's difficult.
It's gotta be scary.
How are people going to go ahead, Michael?
I don't know. It's got to be scary.
It's petrifying.
Yeah.
And to make it even more frightening, my husband passed away. So as much as I'm facing a brand new life with a face that does not have to be covered and something that's a miracle, I'm now faced in a world that I don't have to hide anymore. And I have to, the things that I used to stay in behind, I've now switched and now it's time for me to step forward. And it's been it's a hard adjustment. You do your life one way for so many years and all of a sudden it changes. And as much as it's exciting, you need to do it right and you have to be careful.
No, absolutely. It's almost like being, hitting that reset button on your life. It's almost like being born again. All of a sudden, it's a new world, and the culture changed also. How long were you married the second time?
Well, it's been a long time, and my kids are grown up, and we got through high school and college, and the kids are finally on their own, just doing amazing things. So it's a long time, and it's very difficult for me because I never thought I'd ever be spending my time without my husband. So that's just as much of a challenge. But to be able to all see you lose one, as one would say, God taketh and God giveth, I've been given this opportunity and this new face. And one of the amazing parts of this is most people my age have not had success because you age and your skin weakens and because you need elasticity. The success stories are amazing with the children, and that's really great because those kids need to start getting surgery when they're very little. So it's a wonderful opportunity for me to get involved in an area that has not been talked about. Also, it's such an exciting period of time. Later on tonight, Michael, I'm going to share a very special thing I'm doing. I am hosting a doctor coming from Moscow who is going to be training with Dr. Geronimus and Dr. Bernstein and a couple of the other top laser surgeons in New York City to be able to diagnose and treat. And then she's going to California and working with some of those doctors. And she's going to take that experience and create a clinic in Russia.
Wonderful. Suzanne, we're starting to run out of time, but I want to make a point beforehand. One of the reasons I ask, and I don't really need to know how long, but the reason I ask, how long were you married? Cultures change so drastically. And if all of a sudden, if you're at a certain age and you're out there, quote unquote, single again, dating is not what dating was 20 or 25 years ago. And I am quite confident that people need a class on how to do it.
Oh, Michael, you're so there. I know that. But I'm going to tell you a secret, Michael. I've taken this old-fashioned approach. Back when I was a young girl and I was making the wrong choices or making different choices because I was a different person, I this time have an opportunity to go back and be 21 and make more educated decisions. And I think it has a lot to do with how I feel about myself and who I am, and that will generate like people, and therefore one will kind of step into it. I know it's a little slow process, but I'm hoping that will work. Do you think it will?
Oh, I
think
it
has. The old-fashioned way?
Well, let me tell you what I believe in the old-fashioned way. I think John Wayne should be president of the United States.
I'm there.
Okay, and I graduated high school in 1960, so I kind of sort of understand what you're saying. Suzanne Berger, we have to go, and I want to thank you so much for being here. Is there a website? How do we find you to buy the book?
Well, you're not going to find the book because it will not be available until summer reading next year, but you can always reach me through Facebook, I'm at Viederberger at Gmail, or at Facebook, it's under Suzanne Viederberger. Also, if you're interested and need information, thebirthmark.org is the Vascular Birthmark Foundation's website. Really, if you want have questions about birthmarks or doctors or about the surgery or want to learn more, that is the go-to place. So I definitely will suggest if any folks want to go visit that site to do that. And if you don't get any of that, Michael, will you send me any listeners that want to get in touch with me?
Oh, absolutely. You'll be up on our website so people will see you. Hey, Suzanne, we've got to go, but thank you so much for being here and spreading that message.
Well, Michael, thank you for letting me chat with you and your listeners, and I look forward to talking with you soon. Have a great rest of your evening.
Good night.
Good night.
We'll stay there, stay in those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we're going to bring the best, brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's get together. Let's do it together. Get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Dr. Srini Pillay with us, MD. He's the author of Your Brain and Business, The Neurosciences of Great Leaders. He's a renowned psychiatrist, certified master, executive coach, and the author of Your Brain and Business, The Neuroscience of Great Leaders. He's also an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. As a teacher, trainer, and executive coach, he's worked with a variety of partners and clients, including Mobius Executive Leadership, the Forum Corporation, the World Bank, and the list goes on. And let's say, Srini, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being here. You know, we get into brain sciences today, neurosciences. We've heard so much about it, and it seems to be becoming an integral part of our lives, whether it's business, whether it's social, whatever the case may be. It seems as though we're beginning to learn that our brain has a tremendous effect on the outcome of almost everything we do 24 hours a day.
It really does. You know, and I think initially people thought of it as an academic discipline, but the reality is that people are often making decisions because of things that are going on in their brains. And I think because we realize that some of our decisions are conscious and others are not, trying to understand how the brain works can really make a big difference.
So the average person, now the average person in business, obviously there are disappointments every day, there are shocks every day, there's that nervousness, the anticipation of the decision that's going to be made. And with each one of these experiences, the brain also is working. Is the brain protecting us? Is the brain moving us forward, holding us back? How do we start to control all of the mechanisms of that brain that's in there that really causes what we do and how we are?
Well, you know, there are a number of different ways in which we can do this. I think you make an absolutely accurate point, which is that our everyday anxieties, our causes for concern all register in the brain. And the fear center of the brain is called the amygdala. And when people are afraid, they can either be consciously afraid or they can be unconsciously afraid, meaning you may actually be having anxiety going on in your brain without knowing it. And so what we know from our experiments in science is that when conscious fear affects the brain, it activates the amygdala or the fear center of the brain. And when unconscious fear activates the brain, it still activates the amygdala, meaning if you ask people, what have you seen, when we show them a frightening picture or threatening picture, they say that they've seen nothing, but when we look in the brain, we actually see that the amygdala is activating. And this part of the brain is so sensitive to fear that even in people who have a certain kind of blindness, known as cortical blindness, for all intents and purposes they cannot see, if we present a fearful or threatening picture to them, the amygdala will still activate, indicating that the fear center of the brain really does activate to fear, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And in decision making in businesses, this is actually particularly important because the fear center of the brain connects to the thinking center of the brain. And when you get ripples going through the fear center of the brain, they actually spread to the thinking center of the brain and can disrupt this. Now, this usually works in a U-shaped curve in the sense that initially, the anxiety can actually be organizing. It can help you focus. It can help you concentrate. But at a particular point, you start to have diminishing returns. And what we need to do when we're thinking about brain science in business is to target those parts of the brain that can help us reduce anxiety. And what we do in order to do this is to target the frontal lobe where this thinking occurs that is connected to the anxiety center. And we can also target the actual anxiety center itself. And if you'd like me to go into some of the methods with which we target the frontal lobe, I'd be happy to do that.
No, absolutely. I would love to hear it. Go ahead.
So yes. There are a number of different methods that we use to target the frontal lobe. One of the most powerful methods is reframing. You know, you take a particular situation and you look at it another way. Now, a lot of people might say, well, you know, what difference does that make? You're still looking at the same situation. But what they don't recognize is that when you reframe a situation effectively, it actually changes your brain activation in the frontal lobe, and it changes the activation in the amygdala and can improve thinking with regard to decision-making. So if you take a simple decision like, you know, if a person's in a business and a person's feeling like they've gone through a series of negative occurrences, they've lost money through the last few sales, they're trying to figure out how to recover, there may be some people who are focusing on the losses, whereas other people reframe this and say, I've had these losses, but how do I focus on solutions? And that simple reframing can actually change the activation in the brain. The mnemonic I often use to help people think about this is a mnemonic I call Safe Frame, which is essentially resolving existing conflicts so that you can understand what's going on, reassessing the situation, refocusing, reengaging, and reframing. And essentially, all of those ways are ways of changing the activation in the frontal lobe. But there's also a relatively simple way of accessing the amygdala or the fear center of the brain in high-stress situations. And here what one can do is, rather than overanalyze, because, you know, a lot of times in stressful situations, people are always analyzing and asking why and how did this happen and how do I deal with this. That is helpful up to a particular point. But if you're looking for an effective timeout, if you're looking for a way in which you can reach that fear center directly and decrease its activation, you can do what we call emotional introspection, which is really just a big word for saying mindfulness. And what this means is that we can place our attention on where we feel the anxiety, whether we feel it in our chests or our stomachs. You simply place your attention there without any kind of judgment or analysis. And if you're not feeling the anxiety in a particular part of your body, you can actually just place your attention on your breath. And doing this just for a few minutes will change the activation in your amygdala. In fact, studies have shown that the fear center of the brain will actually decrease its activation if you simply do this without asking any questions or having any judgment.
Okay, Srini, let's take this a little step farther and let's make it a little more simple. So the difference between focus on the loss or focus on the gain, if I focus on the gain, I'm going to release endorphins. I'm going to release certain chemicals. If I focus on the loss, I'm going to release certain chemicals. Based on the chemicals I released from that thought, that picture, that whatever creates the image releases the chemical, it's the activating factor, will cause me to think and feel. So if when you're saying when you refocus, what it does, it it sends out a different chemical for a different reaction. If I'm upset, if I'm depressed, and I decide to smile, if I smile, I'm going to release endorphins. In turn will make me feel good. It'll calm me down. So in essence, if we understand this based on what's going on, if we do the right action will open up the pathway to the brain to get the result we want.
That's a great way of reframing what I just said.
Yeah. Okay, so in essence, that's really what we're dealing with, is if we understand ourselves and understand the dynamic of the brain and what occurs, my goodness, you can control everything that's going on. You wouldn't have to go through the panic and the pressure.
Absolutely. So the brain that is constantly looking out for danger and that is seeking out threat to try to see what is wrong, that particular brain has all of its attention dedicated to negative things. So if you have 10 units of attention, for example, if 7 of those units are taken up looking for negative things, you only have 3 units left for problem solving. So a lot of people are unfair to themselves when they allow their minds to simply be focused on the negative things. If you release your attention from some of those things, and again, this is not an overnight thing, it's something that often requires a lot of practice. Once you learn how to practice this, you can learn how to refocus your attention on what is positive and thereby find more solutions.
Okay, so you said it earlier, I'm just going to repeat it. So if I'm in a business situation and I feel myself extremely stressed, if I can just walk away for a few minutes, quote unquote, take the time out, take a couple of deep breaths, get myself mindful, center myself, and allow the mechanics of my own body to come into play to be able to get me what I want, it's just that simple. The dynamic that occurs is not that simple, but just the process to get there is.
Exactly, because what you have to remind yourself at that point is to change your focus from focusing on the problems to focusing on the solution.
Yeah. Okay, which in essence, that sets up a completely different chain of events.
That's correct.
Oh, okay. And now where did you become aware of this? Where was it? And I know that neuroscience is in the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years is really starting to take advances. Most professionals are starting to realize that there's something beyond a smile or beyond a frown and what occurs and causes you to do and be what you are. But where was it that scientists, this provable part of our world, has started to take a look at this, and the medical profession is looking at it and saying, there's more to what people come in to us to see than meets the eye here?
Well, there are a lot of different contexts in which scientists look at this. They look at it all the way from laboratory studies in animals to the actual lab. In terms of my own life, I had studied brain imaging research for the past 17 years. And so what I did was I worked in a brain imaging laboratory at McLean Hospital, which is Harvard's largest psychiatric hospital. And what we did was essentially ask people to lie in brain imaging scanners while we offered them different stimuli to see how this would change what was going on in their brains. And by looking at what was going on in their brains, we were able to tell what fear would do to the brain or what changing their attention would do to the brain. And this kind of research is not just done at Harvard. It's done in a lot of different centers throughout the country in labs. And the methodology is called functional magnetic resonance imaging. And what that is that we observe changes in brain blood flow when we expose a person to different stimuli.
Now, we have known about the fight-or-flight mechanism for years and years and years and years and years. I don't really think that people have put practical application to the end result of what we're dealing with here. Because that primitive area of mind, if you're in a relationship and somebody looks at you in a certain way, and that image goes to the brain and it's going to move back to a recognizable experience that you had in the past, causing that emotion for today. And I think it's all the same thing. Today, we're really starting to take a look at it and measuring it as it happens and saying, okay, this is the dynamic that occurs. I use that word 1,000 times. This is the dynamic that occurs when you're faced with something. But we are always protecting ourselves. If we don't understand it, if it's not familiar to us, if we don't feel confident within the circumstance that we're in, it's that protection mechanism that comes up. And most people give examples of exaggerated. It happens every day to almost everybody on this planet in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely. It's really so interesting to understand. I think for me, the beauty of this whole field is that we're now at a point where we can begin to apply some of this knowledge. And even how we talk to ourselves at times of stress is actually pretty important. You know, there was a recent study that was done that showed that when you give yourself self-instructions like not, like do not drop the wine on the white couch, or do not do this thing, or do not do this forbidden thing, the brain under stress is much more likely to do the exact opposite of what you're telling it. And I think through, you know, that's another example of how neuroscience and psychological research has helped us understand in that particular instance that when you're framing an instruction to yourself under stress, frame it in the positive rather than the negative. Because when you frame it in the negative, under stress, the conscious brain is not able to actually interpret that. And what ends up happening is you end up doing the exact opposite of what you want.
Well, also, it comes unconscious. You said that early on. Was it Damasio around 1992, 94 something, who created the hypothesis of the somatic marker? And it's that somatic marker that's going to cause something. And it's...
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Nina Amir is back with us, your inspiration to creation coach, inspiring people to create the results that they desire. Nina, hey, welcome back.
Thanks, Michael Ray. It's great to be back.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You're a seasoned journalist, you're an editor, you're a blogger, writing, and an author, coach, and an inspirational speaker, and a Kabbalistic consciousness creation coach. Don't ask me to say that 10 times. Now, but I think what's important, I want to start out with landing a book deal. I think it's so amazing because there's so many writers. There's like 4 million or 2 million, something like that, numbers of brand new books that have hit the street. And they're not all obviously number ones on the Amazon list, but there's so many. But when you deal with a book deal, what is a book deal? Define that.
Well, a traditional book deal is when a publisher actually says, I want to buy your idea and the manuscript that comes with that, and I'm going to send you off a contract, and you're going to sign it, and you're going to produce what you say you're going to produce, and then we're going to publish it.
And they actually pay you money.
Yeah, not a
I like
lot.
That. Yeah.
Days, but yeah, they're going to pay you some money.
Yeah, okay. So actually, that's really what a book deal is. Now, how do you get a book deal? What does your book have to be? How does it have to be different? What does it have to do? What kind of an impact does it have to be able to accomplish something like this?
Well, first of all, it has to be unique in the market. So, you know, you really have to look at the market. When I work with my clients, we spend a lot of time looking at the market and who you're selling to, and then what do they need? What are those people really looking for? Because anyone can go out and buy a book just for entertainment's sake, but I deal mostly with nonfiction. Those people are looking for solutions to problems. Even for fiction, though, people in a lot of cases would like to benefit from reading the book. So you're really looking for the benefits to books, to why would they want to read this book? What are they going to get out of it? And then you're looking at how is it unique on the shelf? What you always talk about, what's the empty place on the shelf that you're trying to fill? And that's what you want to do. You want to fill a spot on the shelf.
Now, a book is not just a book is not just a book. Because I want to touch about, you know, the Kabbalah consciousness and spirituality. There is a realm and there's an area that goes into writing that sometimes goes beyond somebody's consciousness, and then it just kind of pours out, moves through your hand, and it gets, quote-unquote, to pen, so to speak. How does that play into writing?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think that there are a lot of times when a writer gets into the zone, and what comes out of their pen, or in a lot of cases, you know, out of their keyboard, it feels like it's not even them. I can tell you that I go back and read some of what I've written, and I'm surprised. I'm not sure where it came from. I know that, for instance, Diana Gabaldon, who wrote the Outlander series, if you go and read some of what she's written on her website, she'll say that her main character showed up out of nowhere. She did not plan for her. She just showed up in this cabin that she was writing about a cabin and these characters in a cabin, and suddenly the door opened, and I think she was writing about the 17th century, and suddenly this woman from a totally different century showed up there, dressed in the wrong clothing, you know, just totally out of nowhere. She didn't bring her in there on purpose. It just happened, and this woman took over her book, took over the series. So I think that you do get in a zone. And so for people who want to write a book, I think it's important to try to get yourself in that zone as much as you can. And sometimes that takes takes meditating, or it takes, you know, before you write, or it takes being in the right place. So creating a space. I often talk with my clients about creating a sacred writing space. Or it takes just getting really quiet before you write, or setting an intention to help your readers or to give them what it is they need, so that you can kind of, I hate to use the word channel, but you are kind of channeling your higher self in, you know, down onto the page.
Yeah, something not necessarily in that way happened to me the other day. I was doing a few more edits, and there's some things I'm creating in my book, and I read something, and just exactly the way you were saying about this woman who appeared, I said, man, that was good. Where'd that come from? I remember putting that in there. And that's, I think, really what occurs. There's something that happens when it starts to flow through your mind, your hand, wherever it comes from.
There really is. I mean, I look back, I have several books that I'm working on, and some of them, the concepts, I'm not sure where I got those concepts. You know, they are, I learned a little bit about something and it struck a chord, and I put pieces together and I somehow came up with a concept that was totally unique. And I don't know how I did that. It just came to me.
Yeah, and loud and clear. And I think that what we really truly need to do, if we're going to, we as humanity, who whatever project you're going to get into, is to be able to bring it down, hone it down into about 8 or 10 words of who you are and why you're different than the next guy. When that starts to happen, it starts to show up in your writing.
Well, yeah, and the thing is that so many people have good ideas. I was just at a conference, and it happened to be a Jewish spirituality conference or convention that happens every 2 years, and I can't tell you how many people who I sat down with out of the blue, not even knowing that I'm a writing coach and a book editor, started talking to me about ideas they have for books they've started. And the key is that when we have these ideas, and when we feel passionate about them, when it's something that really strikes a chord within us and we feel on some level that it's our purpose or our mission, that it's something we just have to do, that we actually follow through, that we actually start putting it down on paper, because the majority of people don't. They don't do what it takes. And part of it is beginning the writing process, and part of it is allowing that flow to happen and getting in that zone and actually getting it down on paper. But to get a book published, it takes way more than just having a good idea and getting it down on paper. And that's where most people fall short. They need to do a lot more, because it takes more than just being a writer and having a good idea. You have to really be a good business person to get a book published if you want to go the traditional route. But even if you want to self-publish, you really need to be a good business person. And I work with so many of my clients who don't want to do that. I have a client I was working with just the other day, and she has this great idea, and she's really passionate about it. She's a nurse, and it has to do with breast health. And I keep telling her, you know, you need to get a website up, and you need to be blogging, and you need to be doing the social networking, and you need to get out and start speaking. And she's part of the National Speakers Association. She used to be the president of our local chapter of the National Speakers Association, and she's not out speaking on this topic. And they keep saying, this is the work you have to do, because you have to build a following, what's called an author's platform. You have to develop this built-in readership for your book. And she's not doing it. And that's what people who have these great ideas and get inspired need to know, is that they have to do this work in order to get their books published, even if they're going to self-publish them, because you have to have readers.
See, I think a lot of it, too, has to be the definition of what it is to be somebody in business and somebody marketing. You know, obviously, no matter what it is, somebody is selling something to someone. It just works out that way. If it's a product, if it's a cause, a concept, an idea, when your husband said, "Will you marry me?" You could have said yes or no, but you accepted. Sales is acceptance, rejection. You said yes, he sold you, quote unquote. But the problem with that word sales, is that everybody thinks that it, not everybody, most people think that it's a terrible word. Somebody's going to get you a used car that's not going to work, take your money and take off. That is not selling. That's not professional selling or marketing. And I really believe that most of the people who, quote unquote, hate to do it, they hate to do it because they don't understand what it is and they've got it defined in another niche.
That's true. They do. And the question is, how badly do you want to succeed at what you're doing? And if you want, if we're talking about books, if you want to succeed as an author, if you want, which means you want to have a book that succeeds, you have to do this. You have to be a good business person as well. You can't just have a good idea and be a good writer. Matter of fact, you don't even have to be a good writer. You can have a good editor. But you have to be a good business person as well as having a good idea.
Okay, but define a business person.
In the world of publishing, it means being a good business partner for the publisher, or your own good business person if you're going to self-publish. And that means that you are taking the time to research your markets, and you know what your markets are. You're looking at the competition. So basically, it's building a business plan, Michael Ray. It's taking the time to do that. So that's being a business person. You have a market, a business plan. So that means you know your markets, you know your readers, you know what the competition is. You've taken the time to not just have the good idea, but to decide if that idea is angled correctly for your market, if it's filling that hole on the bookshelf, or whether you need to re-angle it. You didn't just go ahead and write the book and then have it flop because it wasn't unique or it didn't meet the needs of the readers. You went ahead and you did all that research in advance. And more than anything, two things. You have built the author's platform. So you have developed a built-in readership by doing social networking, by speaking, by blogging, by doing everything you can possibly think of, YouTube videos, to develop a built-in readership. So when you publish the book or the publisher publishes the book and you say, "Here it is," people run out and buy it. And in addition, you've developed a promotion plan, because publishers these days don't do a lot of promotion. So whether you self-publish or you traditionally publish, you need to have a promotion plan. So basically, okay, you put all this together, it's the same thing as a proposal, a book proposal, and that's the business plan. That's being a good business person, is developing that.
Now, by the way, the other side of that, if we just want to take a word, okay, just a word, and instead of saying a business person, how about you've got to be a good strategist? And I wonder how many people would jump on that word, do the exact same thing, and be happy at the end of the day, and they didn't have to be a business person, they didn't have to market it, but they were doing strategy. I think it's all in the words.
It is, except I think you're right. I totally agree with you, except that writers tend to want to write. They want to be that person sitting in the lonely writer's garret writing. And they really don't want to do the rest of this. And they want to be that person you're talking about, that spiritual person who, maybe they don't want to call it spiritual, but they want to be that person who's in the flow, in that zone, writing, and they really don't want to worry about any of this.
Yeah. No, because remember, they're artists.
That's right. They are.
Yeah, got it.
They are, but they can't just be artists if they want to succeed in today's publishing world.
And I think the biggest problem, you know, with a lot of the people that get involved in it, they're not told what to expect once they get there, and they're expecting the wrong thing. If they can get it, they get to people like yourself. You put them in the right direction. They know what to expect, what not to expect, what they have to do. And if they're not willing to do it, then don't do it and go home and cook cookies or something.
Right. There was a woman at the San Francisco Writers Conference. I was volunteering there one year, and she showed up in the volunteer lounge in tears, and she sat there and just cried because she said, I came here thinking I was just going to land an agent and get my book published, and that would be it. And now I suddenly found out that I need this author's platform, and it's going to take me all these years to build, and I have to do all this work, all these things I need to do. I need to be a speaker. And she was just devastated because she had no idea. And I remember what that felt like because my first book proposal went out, and I had an agent call me, and she was all excited about my book, but she said, I can't represent you because you have no platform.
Well, by the way, Radio Susie is sitting here across the desk with her computer, and she looked up at me, and she wrote me a note, and the note said, where's the cookies? The note said, don't publishers help you with that as a publicist?
Don't they help you with the publicity?
Yeah, and to get out
not
there
really,
and to do those things.
Not that much, a little bit.
Okay,
so the book deal I just landed with Writer's Digest Books, they told me that it's going to be top of their list, so they will help me some. But they won't. They don't help that much, which is why some people are choosing, or not some, a lot are choosing to self-publish because you make way more money. You know, royalties are not big. You know, the percentage you get from a traditional publishing house are very small. So you make way more money if you self-publish and you do the same amount of work. But my contention has always been that a traditional publishing house helps you with distribution and does help you some with promotion. Writer's Digest will help me a fair amount with promotion because I know what they do for books on writing. They do some teleseminars and webinars and workshops, and they've already told me that my particular book will be top of their list next year. So I know that it will get some promotion, but in general, not much.
Now, Nina, what is an agent?
A literary agent is your business partner. They are what you need, and I emphasize need, to get in the door of a larger publishing house. The majority of mid-sized to large publishing houses will not look at what's called unagented proposals. So you need a book proposal, and the book proposal goes to the publishing house. But if it doesn't show up via an agent, the larger publishing houses won't look at it, and some of the mid-sized publishing houses won't either because they trust the agents to only bring them the good work. Now, the mid-sized, some mid-sized, and the smaller publishing houses will look at unagented work, but your literary agent is the one who will get you in the door.
Ah, okay, so everybody has their job. Now, if you created the team and you had the money to do it, how much work do you personally have to do then?
Well, so for instance, for me, I still agreed to pay a fair amount of money to advertise my book, advertise myself and my book in order to get more radio appearances. I agreed to spend a certain amount of money to go to three or four different cities around the country to speak. I agreed to spend some money for press releases and that sort of thing. So I'm still spending a fair amount of money. Oh, and a blog tour. I agreed to do a blog tour. That will cost me some money if I don't do it myself. So you're still spending a fair amount of money on promotion.
Sure, but in the end result, when it really comes down to it, in the end result, no matter what they say to you, no matter who said the literary agent, the publicist, the publicist, the publisher, all of them, in the end result, it's up to you.
It's up to me to do the work.
It's up to you to get it done, yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because the publisher is going to promote it to some extent, like I said. I mean, I have a specific type of publisher, but if you had the average publisher, they will get it into some of the bookstores. They will get it better distributed, but they're not going to run any ads, not for a first-time writer, not for a first-time author. They won't run any ads. They're not going to do the blog tour for you. I mean, they might assist you to some extent, but they're really not going to do a lot. It's really going to be up to the author, which is very sad.
So, really when it comes down to it, and I've talked to people about this for years and years now, that they don't tell you when it comes down to it, when in the end result, when you've got your name out there, when you've got the book out there, when you've got all your press releases going, etc., it's what you do when you're in front of the public that's going to make or break you.
Yes, and what nobody tells you is if you don't sell books, they will not publish another book of yours. And I have friend who had a book, who has a book, and it was published by Wiley, which is a very, you know, one of the better publishers, a bigger publisher, and she sent them another proposal, and the response from her agent got, so she had an agent, the agent sent the proposal over, the response from the publisher was, we will never publish another one of her books. And the agent said, why? And they said she only sold 3,500 books in the first, I can't remember how many months. Well, let me tell you, the average book these days sells 300 books a year, 3,000 in its lifetime. She sold 3,500 in something like 6 months or a year. She sold better than average, and they said they would never sell, they would never buy another one of her books because she didn't do enough to promote her book.
Mm.
So it tells you something about how they're looking at book sales and how important that is to them. So you have to sell way over that. I had a book listed as one of my complementary or competing books. I think it was a complementary book, so that's a section in your book proposal. And they look at that, and they try to look at how many books. So you're comparing your book idea to other books out in the market that are either similar or competing with yours. They go and they look to see how many of those books have sold to see whether they think your book will sell that many. One of those books on my book proposal has sold over 100,000 copies, and the publisher said, oh, the books in your competing and complementary section haven't sold enough. 100,000 copies wasn't enough.
No, I hear it loud. So, Nina, let me hold you up because we're starting to run out of time, and you know I could talk to you all night long. Website we can find you at?
The best place to find me is at ninaamir.com, and that's ninaamir.com.
Okay, and Nina, and by the way, we can buy the books and find out all about your coaching and everything else there.
Yeah, you can click through to my other two websites, copyrightcommunications.com there and buy the books there or at purespiritcreations.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Nina Amir, see you next week.
All right, thanks.
Good night.
Leaving their baby behind. Did you hear this poor little child was only 9 years of age when mother and dad went away? She bravely worked at the one thing she knew to earn her few pennies a day. She made artificial flowers, flowers for ladies of fashion to wear. She made artificial flowers, you know those artificial flowers, fashion from Annie's despair. With paper and shears, with some wire and wax, she made up each tulip and mum. As snowflakes drifted into her tenement room, her baby little fingers grew numb from making artificial flowers. Artificial flowers, flowers for ladies of high fashion to wear. She made artificial flowers, artificial flowers, made from Annie's despair. They found little Annie all covered with ice, still clutching her poor frozen shear. Amidst all the blossoms she had, fashioned by hand, and watered with all her young tears. There must be a heaven where little Annie can play.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And instead of a halo, she'll wear around her head
a garland of genuine flowers. No more artificial flowers. Throw away those artificial flowers.
Ben Shapiro with us. He's the author of Primetime Propaganda, the true Hollywood story of how the left took over your television set. He's called The Future of Conservative Movement. 27-year-old Ben Shapiro is the host of The Ben Shapiro Show on WEUS 810 AM in Orlando, Florida. He's also the best-selling author of Brainwashed and Porn Generation. Ben Shapiro, it has been a long time since you and I have been on the air together.
Yeah, it has been a while. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you? You're coming off a long way since then. Primetime Propaganda, Ben, when you took a look at this, and better yet, let's go back to when you were in college. Obviously, you were there. You were living the life of a college student. What was it like being in college and being a conservative?
I loved it. I'm always a big fan of going into the lions, and I just enjoy it. It's something fun for me, so being in a place where I was surrounded by people of differing points of view and I was supposed to slug it out with them, that was actually my idea of a good time. And so I kind of reveled in that. I liked going to the rallies and being the only counter-protester. I liked challenging professors in the classroom. I liked messing with their heads. So I was kind of it's a good way to channel your rabble-rousing, troublemaking instinct.
In a constructive way. Ben, let me ask you this. We have Democrats, we have Republicans. But it's not the Democrats and the Republicans that are the problem. It is the progressives and it is the extreme on either end. Do you think that they truly, really represent the basic constituency?
I'm not sure. I do think that, you know, certain ideologies are more problematic than others. Obviously, the extremes on either end are going to be a problem. But I think that, you know, mainstream Democrats are more of are a problem. And I think so are mainstream Republicans. I think that what we really need in this country is some basic common sense. I mean, there's really, it's amazing. It doesn't seem to matter whether it's Republicans or Democrats. Everybody just keeps spending. That is not appropriate any longer. I think the American people have made pretty clear what their will is. Leave the government out of our lives, and we're basically pretty happy folks. Just enforce the laws, make sure that our borders are taken care of and that we stay safe at night, make sure that my family isn't attacked by hoodlums. And that's pretty much all I ask of you is the government. Otherwise, leave me alone.
You know, by the way, you and I sit on the same side of the table with that 100% across the board. But we're seeing some very different things. I want to take you all the way back to the right before the Second World War. And neither one of us was around, you know, when right before the war started. Hitler got to Germany. Hitler nationalized the school system, the educational system. He nationalized the financial system. He nationalized the government. And I'm starting to see the very same thing happening here. But I want to talk about it on television. Where is it? Why is it that there's such a push by left-wing extremists and how have they invaded television? Who owns that? Why is that those mindsets there in the first place driving what agendas they have?
I mean, I think there are a couple of reasons why you see that in the television industry. The first is that the creators themselves happen to be very much to the left, and that's not unusual. Artists are typically the people who comment on society and sit outside society and kind of critique it. So that's not, you know, tremendously unusual. What is unusual is that they have such a guilt instinct about it that they feel guilty, I think, about making a lot of money. I mean, most of the people who inhabit these big houses on Sunset Boulevard are socialists. And so, there's a basic kind of cognitive dissonance there. And the way that they come to consonance, the way that they solve that is by saying, well, you know, okay, so, yeah, I make a lot of money, but at least I'm using it to pursue social justice. At least I'm pushing for the social justice agenda. And what that means is that they feel a kind of internal necessity to push for a very hard left agenda. In terms of the executives are by and large left as well. They want to do something, you know, quote-unquote good for the world. And for them, it means largely the same thing that it does.
Yeah, I'm here. We just went dead. Did we lose Ben? Oh, okay. All right. That we'll get Ben back. Somehow we lost our connection. But when you realistically take a look at it, there's a tremendous amount of people living, they're talking a talk, but they're not walking a walk. There's a tremendous amount of money being made, and there are actors today that we won't even have to name them, but they go to different countries. They go to France, they go to England, spend the money that they've made here and talk about how bad it is here. So there's a problem in definition of what money really is. We've got people living the great life. They're living the great life. They're making a tremendous amount of money. And yet at the same time, they want to tax. They want to get rid of they want to tax the wealthy. You tax the wealthy and one thing happens. And the wealthy does not invest. And if they don't invest, there are not jobs created. If you take the wealthy and those especially in business and you quote unquote, you pound them down, what you find is they will move out of the states. They'll move out of the country and they will move away from where they're being harassed. We started this country out many years back and the basic intention was we live in a free market society. You can make as much as you want to make and as long as obviously you stay within the law and you can make as much as you want to make and you can be anything that you want to be. Well, we're fighting that right now. We are saying you can't make as much as you want to make and you can't be anything that you want to be. And everybody wins. Everybody does not win. If you get kids going to school and they're playing football, somebody wins, somebody loses. Yes, everybody wins if they play the game, no question. But somebody is going to lose. So what's the message there? The message is they're not less than somebody else. The message there is get better the next time and get in there and win the second time. You can't have a football field where everybody's running in the same direction to score. It doesn't work that way. Because if the mindset is that, if the kids in school get that particular mindset, what's going to happen when they get out into the world of business? Because they think somebody shouldn't be doing something in a certain way, the battle starts. You know, there's a rule, and the rule is what you do for the person that you work for is do what you are told to do if they're going to pay you for it, as long, obviously, as there's integrity in it. So we've gotten so far off course that effectively, I don't know if we're going to be able to steer our way back. We're looking at some of the things that are going on in the schools today. Condoms are being given out to the kids. If you want an abortion and not to tell your parents, that can happen for you also. The parents are losing complete control. So this falls into what? Nationalistic society. And more the government controls, the more and more the government takes over, the less and less freedom that you actually have. So what do you do with that? Where are you in your situation whereby you feel like you can go out and live your life, do what you want to do? But you can't. Free speech is not free. Free speech doesn't exist anymore. And I think I heard a sound, and we might have Ben back. Ah, okay. Well, we're pretty good. We've got, do we have another guest coming up right after this? Or we have a break? We have one. Okay, so we have, how about, let me take a look at this. And we can do that from that. I'll tell you what. Why don't we throw something in the interim, and then we'll go right to our next guest at the appropriate time. How's that sound? Seth, can we do that? Oh, good. Oh, good. We lost each other. I was just getting into, and you're going to be more of an expert on this than I will ever be. I was getting into the school system, what's being taught in the school system. And in essence, the same thing that's happened, the propaganda in primetime is running right through the schools today, the grammar schools, the junior high schools, the condoms that get distributed, the abortions that they can get. And I think one of the things that are going on right now, the second, third, and fourth graders, they're giving classes in gender identity, which is a little too young for any of that. And with that,
That's certainly the case. I mean, if you look at the California school system, I just wrote a column recently and I think this is apropos to television, which is that the left has purveyed this really big lie over the course of many years, which is that what happens in your bedroom should stay in your bedroom. Now, I think most Americans agree with that. I certainly agree with that. I don't care what you do in your bedroom, and you know, I don't want you in my bedroom. That is my business and it's your business. But what the left has done is they haven't made it their business. They've decided, okay, you know, if I'm doing something in my bedroom, that deserves to be taught in school. That now deserves to be given some sort of societal legitimacy, some societal grant of decency. And that I do have a problem with. And that you see in California. In California, this last week they passed a law that is now forcing public schools, and didn't have an age requirement, forcing public schools to start teaching gay history. Well, I don't see why you should be teaching gay history to a second or third grader. And one of the basics of gay history was, you know, we're going to teach you who is gay in history. Well, what does Leonardo da Vinci's sexual preference have to do with his art? Why does that make any difference with regard to, you know, whether he's a good artist or what he invented or any of that stuff? All it is a way for people to say, you know, you ought to give full societal sanction to my sexual activity. Well, look, I don't care what. Now you've moved beyond the what's private stays private. Now you've moved into what was private is now public, and I'm supposed to approve of it. And that's a very different story.
No, absolutely. And I really think when you really come down to it, the direction that we've taken socially, I don't think that if you went back 20 or 30 years ago that it would have been acceptable in any way, shape, or form. What I really believe is happening, Ben, is this, that we are the most potent force in the world. Toe-to-toe, you cannot beat the United States of America. You just can't. It's not going to happen. I don't care what country you are. But if you want us, what you do is you cause us to implode. You cause us to divide. If you divide, you conquer. And each time that we get something like, you know, the gay issues coming up, there's going to be somebody taught there, and then you've got one element against the other. Then you got the unions going. Then you got one element against the other. And then you've got the difference and the divides in races, which is getting stronger and stronger today. And I can't believe what's going on. We just had here in the Milwaukee area a gang of 40, 50 kids. They were African-American. They're going down the street. They're breaking into places, and they're beating people up. For what? That's where the key is. You divide us, and you're going to kill us. And that's what's happening with the erosion of the economy.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, President Obama is definitely pitting Americans against Americans, and largely by using the unions as his wedge. I mean, that's what this whole corporate jets issue is. Now, I don't understand what that has to do with why he wants to raise my taxes. I don't use corporate jets. I'm okay with, you know, if you want to tax corporate jets, you know, go for it, as long as you don't raise anybody else's taxes. The problem is that he's not really talking about corporate jets, is he? I mean, what he's really talking about is raising taxes on everybody who's not a constituent of his, and those happen to be the people who don't pay taxes in this country, the people who are members of unions, the people who get their paycheck from the public till. And that is where I have a significant difference of opinion with most Democrats when it comes to the economy. Again, stay out of my business. I don't want you taking my money. And guess what? You don't have a right to my labor. Don't tell me that because I live in this country, you get to own my labor. It's not your labor. It's my labor. And by the same token, I don't own your labor. And it bothers me on a deep emotional and really, you know, philosophical and moral level, this notion that is pervaded by some people on the left, that because I live in this country alongside you, you therefore have a right to what I make for a living. It's absurd.
Yeah, but that's socialism. That really comes down to socialism. And communism is nothing more than a scientific form of socialism. You cannot spread the wealth. And, you know, and then we get into situations whereby, what do you want to do with welfare? There was a young man, what was it, 3-4 weeks ago that was killed in New York City. And I think it was in his early 20s, early to mid-20s, African-American kid had, six daughters and three sons, and he was getting $1,350 a piece from welfare for each one of these kids. So we have to really take a look at what's going on. Why shouldn't I have a bunch of kids if I'm going to get $1,000 or so a month for each kid, and I can live very well on $9,000-$10,000 a month, and I don't have to work?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. We're incentivizing people toward bad behavior, and that's another problem here, is that it's not just that President Obama is pitting us against one another, that Democrats have done that for a long time. It's the concept that you no longer have to be responsible for your own behavior. And this is one of the big, I think that this is the real moral debate of our time. And I think this is where social issues cross paths with financial issues. I think that when you tell people that they're not responsible for their behavior, you know, that it's natural, in the words of Lady Gaga, that you're born this way, as soon as you get into that sort of territory, you may very well be born that way. I'm not arguing that. What I'm arguing is that just because you are doesn't mean you have to behave in a certain way. And once we get away from the idea that you are responsible from your behavior, that you can overcome your internal nature, whether that's with regard to cheating somebody in business or whether that's with regard to, you know, how you live your life on a personal level, once we move away from that, we've lost all semblance of morality, and then it's just, then it really does become a dog eat dog world. And again, what I'm not saying here that you know, being gay means that you're going to cheat in business. That's not what I'm saying at all. All I'm saying is that a society that does not uphold certain moral standards, including the very basic moral standard that you're responsible for your behavior, is a society that is going to create a lot more immorality.
Ben Shapiro, we're just about out of time, but I want to talk about something called consequence. The problem is there isn't consequence today. I remember years ago when I was in junior high school, you stepped out of line, you went into the coach's office or the vice principal's office, you bent over, you put a telephone book between your head and the wall, and you got swatted. And once in a while, he missed your rear end and caught you against the back of your thighs. I promise you, you didn't want to go back in there, and you didn't do it. Nobody was emotionally upset. We didn't need a counselor. We got up, and we went out and said, I'm not going back there again. And that's the way it worked. Ben, we got to go. Website we can find you at and buy the books.
You can go visit my website at benjaminshapiro.com, and you can you can follow me at Twitter at Ben Shapiro. You can also find my book at both benjaminshapiro.com, at Amazon, at your local bookstore. If you want it for free, go to declarationentertainment.com and give a donation. It's a 501c3 organization, and they will they'll send you a copy of this book signed for free.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for being here. And is your show streamed?
It is. You can go to big810am.com, and that'll stream it for you.
Hey, wonderful. Hey, Ben, thank you so much for joining it. And we shouldn't wait as long as we did this last time before you come back on again.
Oh, absolutely. Sounds great.
Okay, thanks, and good night. Thank you for being here.
You are.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Yeah, it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all.
Jim Lockie with us. He's a veteran of the education system in Nevada, a teacher for more than 20 years, and he teaches at-risk kids. He's run for U.S. Congress twice and is desperately trying to save our education system. He's the member of the Tea Party West, founder of the local chapter of the Christian Educators Association, and a former board member of the Nevada Concerned Citizen. He provides common sense solutions about how to improve the quality of the U.S. education system, and is the author of Teachers, It Ain't Your Fault. And let's say, Jim, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey there, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. I mean, I think the headline says it all, yours. If a student hits you, it's your fault. I don't think so. Where did we get those ideas?
Well, you know, actually, it was, we have just a wonderful segue from the last gentleman you had, the last guest you had, as far as personal responsibility. It happens through a lack of personal responsibility. I mean, just look at our school system right now, and just take a look at what he was just talking about, how important personal responsibility is. And now, this is something that even happens with my fellow conservative Republicans, is how do they want to fix education? They want to make teachers accountable for students' actions. Student achievement will determine how good a teacher you are. So it's not how good a teacher I am, it's how good a student I have. So if I have a bad year, I mean, a group of bad kids one year, all of a sudden I'm a bad teacher.
Sure.
And, you know, and then the next year, if I have a great group of kids, then I'm a great teacher. So, I mean, you know, and it has to go back to personal responsibility. How well a child learns in my classroom depends a little bit on me, but depends on more on his desires, his home life, and what he wants out of education than what I can teach him. You know, I mean, it's the old adage, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And I've seen a lot of teachers just totally, totally frustrated by trying to work with these children, with these kids, and not be successful at it, and then have the principals and the leadership and just come down on these teachers like it's their fault. And these are great teachers that this happens to, and it's a shame. It's because we take away personal responsibility from the students, and of course, you know, the parents of the students, they have to be held accountable also because, I mean, they're raising their children.
Sure. I think, Jim, there's a word that comes to mind here, and it's called value. You know, is the value for staying in school, is the value for learning senior to the value for dropping out and not? I did there was an interview that I did probably 20, 25 years ago, and it was about a doctor who was dealing with the AIDS epidemic in Africa. And he said, we need education, we need education, we need education. And I said, how old do these kids live to be? And he said, well, you know, 23, 24. And my comment was, well, if you're 14, 15, 16 years old, and you know you have nothing to look forward to, there isn't a job, there isn't any kind of continuous education, you're just going to grow up to be 23, 24 years old and die, what would stop you from having sex? Nothing. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die anyway. So I truly believe it's in the value proposition, the value for staying in school, the value for listening, the value for getting your education has got to be senior than the value for dropping out. And obviously it's not, because you're right in the middle of this. Look at the dropout rate in schools of cross country. I think the last time I saw it was something like 25% on average. And if you go to Detroit, it even gets higher.
It's a lot higher in Detroit. And I think that is one of the problems we have in our education system, is we put way too much of a focus on the dropout rate. We don't put nearly enough focus on the drop-in rate. And, you know, there's just some kids who they're not going to get it until they get older. They want to go to school, and they don't really care to be educated. They're there to, you know, they're at the party to socialize, sell drugs, whatever it is. They're there, and all they do is disrupt. And what they do is they take education away from those kids who want to be there, and they discourage a lot of kids who want to be there. And so there's a lot of kids who want to be there that drop out because they get discouraged from all these knuckleheads who come to school and disrupt the class and don't let them have a chance to learn. If they have a problem in class, they don't have time to ask a question because the teacher has to spend so much time on discipline and all the goings on. They call it classroom management, which irritates the heck out of me. If I wanted to be a manager, I'd have gone to Taco Bell. I can manage there. I wanted to be a teacher, which means I wanted to teach. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to have to deal with discipline problems 10, 15 minutes a day. You know, little things is not a big deal once in a while, but to have to deal with, you know, and 10 or 15 minutes worth of discipline problems and just all sorts of different problems in the classroom, it hurts our education system.
Let me tell you where I think the biggest problem when you say discipline, I don't even know if they understand the definition of that anymore, or if there is any. There was that kid, had to be about a year or so ago, and if you saw it on television, she couldn't have been more than, second grade. They had her in the principal's office, and she was ripping books off the wall and whatever, and they put the camera in there, and they were showing everybody had their hands behind their back to prove that they weren't putting their hands on the kid, and the kid was having a fit, and she was tearing books off and messing up desks, and finally the police came in, and they had to handcuff her. I mean, she couldn't have been more than whatever a second or third grade is, whatever age that
probably
is.
7, 8 years old, I think she was, yeah.
Yeah, and then there was a lawsuit going on, etc. But it was the point, Jim, that they brought the camera in just to show that nobody touched her. That's not right.
It's not right to not touch her? Or it's not right, for the child to act that way?
Let me put it this way. You get a kid tearing up your office, doing what? What are you going to do? Watch her do it because you don't touch her? I'm sorry. I think you pick her up and you sit her in a chair or you throw her out of your office. You can't just let her do it.
I was being sarcastic. But, it's true. That is and it starts at the second and third grade right now is when you start seeing the discipline problems really start acting up. It used to be the fourth and fifth grade. But, the kids are learning, and it's earlier and earlier on. The week my book came out, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I was terminated the week my book came out by the school district.
No, I wasn't aware of that.
They accused me of hitting a kid. Now, they had video of the entire thing, which they didn't show me until my arbitration. And the arbitrator kind of laughed and told the school district, he says, why are you bringing this in? This is evidence for the defense. I mean, it shows blatantly that I didn't touch the kid. I not only didn't hit him, I didn't touch him. And he kind of laughed and threw the case out. But it's just, shows what I or any teacher who speaks out, what we have to go through in the school system because we just are not allowed to speak. Because if we do, they harass us, fire us, whatever they can do. So the next time you hear that it's really impossible to fire a teacher, don't believe it. It's just that they fire the people they want to fire, which is usually the ones, like I said, it's usually conservative Christian men and women that actually speak out and want to actually do something to fix what's wrong with education.
See, and the problem, Jim, is
that's really what's my
education.
Goal. I mean, it breaks my heart seeing what happens to these kids who come to class, cuss out a teacher, and nothing happens to that kid. I mean, they go through, their first 17, 18 years of their life thinking that's how they can treat authority figures. Then they go out and get a job and do that to their employer, and all of a sudden, boom, they're fired three or four times, and they just can't figure it out. Why? Because they've gotten away with so much in the school system for so long, and it just breaks my heart seeing some of these kids, because not all of them are bad. In fact, most of them are. Most of them just, they're looking for discipline. They're looking for someone to give them guides and a guideline, that. I mean, you're an intelligent, man, and you've had kids. You have kids, right?
Oh, sure.
And so you've disciplined them, and all those are guidelines and borders.
It's more than in the educational system. It's at home also. And why did I say it's at home? Can you imagine, and just give me a feel of what you go through when I'm going to say what I'm going to say next. Can you imagine standing in front of your mom or dad and using a four-letter expletive to them?
Oh, gosh, I would have never done that.
You bet.
I would have been flying across
the hair
the
on the back of my neck still stands up thinking about it.
That's so true.
But these kids do that today. And if mom or dad whack the kid in the rear end, the next morning you've got either the police there or the kid's attorney. I mean, we've lost total control over our children, and if they're owned, they're owned by the school system.
Yeah, and it's just, you really need, I mean, we can't control what goes on at home, but we can control what goes on in the school system, man. And kids who are just constantly being disruptive, and I'm not saying we give kids way too many opportunities, but we need to remove those kids who are disruptive because they're ruining education. They don't respect teachers. Kids don't respect teachers because our society doesn't respect teachers, especially right now. You look at all the people who are out there trying to save education. How are they going to do it? What is the first thing that comes out of us? Well, we need to get rid of bad teachers. We need to be able to fire them, easier. We need to get rid of teacher tenure. We need to give them raises by student achievement, how a student does. And so what that tells these kids is that, heck, I've got a built-in excuse. If I fail, it wasn't my fault. It was the teacher's fault. Even you guys said it. You guys said teachers, there's bad teachers out there, teachers suck and all that kind of thing. And I have, Mr. Dresser, I have been told more than once by a child that if I failed him or her, that it wouldn't reflect bad on them, it would reflect bad on me. They said that would make you a bad teacher. if you fail me, you're a bad teacher. It's your fault, not mine. I've been told that many, many times by kids. They figured it out. They have a built-in excuse. They don't have to try.
And
this
absolutely.
Comes from kids who, and this comes from kids who have missed 15, 20, 25 days out of a 45-day quarter. They still expect to be passed. Otherwise, it's my fault.
Yeah, see, Jim, it's very easy to blame, but they've been taught to blame. It is in our administration and it doesn't matter what president is up there right now. It's in the administration and it trickles its way down. But especially today, and in the world that we live in, it's not their fault. They're poor babies and they're victims. They're taught to be victims.
Yeah.
The moment that something goes on, in comes the consular. And with all due respect to a lot of these counselors, they cause a problem.
Oh, without a doubt. And so do the deans and the principals. And I actually had a principal who, when I kicked the kid out of class for being disruptive, he would feed the kid first. And then he would tell the student, he says, well, you have to understand, Mr. Blocky is a real a-hole. And, you know, you just have to put up with him in your class. And that was how he fixed that problem.
Great way to fix a problem, and a great way to garner respect. I think that's the other side of it. The kids are brought up today to be taught not to respect, and I think that in and of itself is a problem. And it's going way too far now. I don't even know if we can fix this thing. Look at the video games they get to watch. You know, the carjacking and the killing and the so on and so forth.
Oh my gosh, yes.
You can't watch a movie without somebody getting their head ripped off and shot in the head 10 times now. So what is
it
that
and,
they?
Right, you know, and not just that, but you know, all the sex that goes on. I mean, it's no wonder
absolutely.
We have kids having sex at 10 years old. I mean, they've seen death more often than. I mean, I remember when I grew up, if someone got killed in a car wreck, it made the news. I mean, it was big news, and everybody was shocked and hurt. Now, I mean...
Well, I hate to say how old I am, Jim, but when I was a kid, at the end of the movie, especially if it was a Western, the cowboy kissed the horse, not the girl.
That's right. Well, I hate to say how old I am, too, but when I was around... I watched Moses split the river, so I mean...
Yeah, I hear you. But see,
what
it really comes down to, there's a world that doesn't exist anymore, and I think that in and of itself is a major problem. And if it's the teacher's
fault...
it's
not that we can't get it back. We can fight. I mean, we're always going to have the technology in those type of games, but we can always keep kids accountable and students accountable and parents accountable, and it's just a matter of... You know, discipline needs to be a deterrent to be effective. And
that's
what we need to do. We need to make things a deterrent for kids. So like when they get a suspension for 3, 5, 10 days, they don't go home and play video games for 3, 5, and 10 days. Send them out. Let them do community service for 3 days,
sure.
5 days. Let them go clean toilets, scrub, you know, toilets for a few days instead of, I guarantee you, they'll think twice before they cuss that teacher out again. I'll guarantee you that.
But that's the whole point. There's no consequence. Now, I'm going to take it a step farther, which they would never agree to. I think there's nothing wrong with a swat in the rear end. That's not beating someone. That's not molesting anybody. That's just saying, hey, this is not what you do. And if it's enough of a shock, they won't do it again. And that doesn't mean make somebody bleed. That's not where I'm at with it.
No, but make them sting.
Corporal, there's nothing wrong with a little corporal punishment.
Yeah, and that's the problem a lot of times in this country, you know, in the last 30, 40 years. If two people do something terrible, they ruin it for everybody else. Corporal punishment was abused by very few teachers, and so they just got rid of it all together. Rather than just getting rid of the few teachers that abused it, they got rid of it all together. And, you know, I mean, I can still see, you know, hey, you know, a better idea instead of the principal doing a swatting, make the parent come down. Hey, your kid needs a SWAT. You're going to come down and do it.
So yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. And I really believe when it comes down to it, and we're starting to run out of time, but Jim, if they don't learn consequence, whatever that consequence is, cleaning toilets or whatever the case, if they don't learn consequence, how are they going to deal in the life after school? How are they going to deal with either on the job or ongoing and continuing education and then finally get out? So there's a problem there because what they learn in school, and if it's going to be non-responsibility, they're going to take that with them with the rest of their life unless they get taught a lesson real quick. Anyways, Jim Blocky, we got to go. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, it's jimblocky.com/teachersitaintyourfault. And that explains everything. I've got a blog also, educationalknowledge.wordpress.com. And every Tuesday and Fridays I write in that and explain a little bit about, you know, something that's going on in education. It's not lost. We may have lost a generation or come close to it, but this is fixable. I mean, it's very simple. We need to not make it complicated, which it doesn't have to be. We need to fix it simply, do it one step at a time, and we can take our education system back and get rid of this, you know, socialistic education system that we have right now.
Wonderful. Hey, Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Good night.
That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Nance Perry coming up right after this.
They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Nance Perry with us. She's the author of the ebook, How to Avoid, Handle, Litigate Over Sexual Harassment. She's written scripts, romance, suspense, and nonfiction novels, young adult fiction, and children's books, short stories, poems, magazine, newsletters, and newspaper articles, as well as website text, technical writing, and copywriting. And aside from writing, she's also worked as a waitress, editor, PR consultant, switchboard operator. My goodness, Nance, what do you do in your spare time?
Who has spare time?
Okay. And a 14-year acting career, also true. Now, it ended after 3 sexual harassment lawsuits against ABC TV, AFTRA, the Actors Union, and the stage manager of General Hospital. When we talk about sexual harassment today, and, you know, with the lawsuits, et cetera, is this going out of control? Is this something that the world needs to take a look at, but at the same time, really define what harassment is as opposed to, and I'm not saying this is you, as opposed to somebody getting some attention?
Right. I think sexual harassment has always been there. I think it will always be there, unfortunately, because sexual harassers are bullies, and bullies will always be around. They're
sure.
Sociopaths. There are people who just don't know how to have an impact on others or on the world in a positive way. So they pull something negative, something aggressive and hurtful, and get some sort of sick power rush from it. And that's
now,
where sexual harassment comes from.
Now, by the way, when we talk about sexual harassment, is that physically touching someone, or is harassment just because you're a female, you get quote-unquote, they think they're going to put you in your place, or how is sexual harassment, how do we recognize what it really is? How do we define it?
Right. Sexual harassment actually can be many things. It really is in the eye of the beholder. Sexual harassment can be words. Somebody can be describing your body parts or you know, how great they think you look and get, you know, a little too personal with it. It can be propositions, requests for dates. It can be obscene phone calls. It can be touching, of course, obviously, molestation and rape. It can also be non-sexual. It's still considered sexual harassment, creating an unpleasant atmosphere in the workplace. It's also considered harassment.
Okay, now, the three lawsuits that you had, was there a common theme through all three lawsuits?
Well, yeah, I was on General Hospital. I just did little extras and under five jobs. That's five lines or less in soap opera terms. For 12 years on that show, and the whole time the stage manager was harassing me and pretty much everyone else he could. He didn't harass the stars of the show because he knew it was more than his job was worth, but anyone who was an extra or a day player or somebody who was, you know, not a big star was getting harassed by him. This was the men, too. Now, he was straight. He was sexually harassing the women, but he was bullying the men. And he was employed there for 15 years, and he made a very good salary. When I sued ABC, they claimed that management didn't know what he was doing. Management knew. Everybody knew. My attorney talked to Gloria Monty, who was the executive producer of the show at the time, and got her to admit that she knew, but she didn't consider it a problem because it wasn't happening to her big stars of the show. It didn't matter that women were getting molested and raped and all the rest of it. She, on the set, in the dressing rooms, by this guy, she didn't consider it a problem. I also went to the union because when you become an actor and you join an actor's union, you have to go to a big meeting. It's a big round table meeting with all the new people who've just joined the union, and they tell you, we're your union, we're there for you. If you have a problem on the set, you call us. We're there to help you. I contacted them by phone, by letter, and personally, at least six times in 12 years, they did nothing. They admitted to my attorney after we were in the process of suing them that they had a file drawer full of complaints about this guy. They did nothing. And, you know, I told everybody, I the harasser, I told him to leave me alone, it didn't matter. So when actually a friend of mine was attacked in the dressing room, one of the girls who played a nurse on the show. And when I found out that she was attacked, I offered to testify in court with her. She told me that she was suing ABC. And I told her that I had been harassed, too, for a long time by the stage manager. And if she wanted me to, I would testify with her in court about this guy. In that way, I met her attorney. He settled her case out of court and then asked me if I wanted to sue, which is solicitation, by the way, and they're not supposed to do that, but he did. And my response to him was, I feel like if I don't speak up, if I don't do something, it's like saying what this guy did was all right, and it wasn't all right. But I didn't want to just sue him. I wanted to hold people responsible for all of the people who let it go on for so long. So I sued ABC, AFTRA, and the stage manager.
You know, one of the things that I'm surprised about, because the way, the sensitivity that we have in the media today towards all of these things that are going on, the political correctness that started years ago and whatever, that somebody would be, I want to use the word dumb. Dumb, no, I won't use the word,
yeah.
I'm going to use the word stupid, okay? Stupid enough to go ahead and harass people. You know, dumb, yeah, if you want to define it, is doing something and you don't know better. Stupid is doing it and when you know better. And when you've got a situation whereby society, the culture, is completely down on this and you do it anyway, there's something wrong there.
Yeah, well, he was compulsive. You know, there seems to be a psychosis that goes along with this, that it's been my observation. The people I've been sexually harassed by all seem to have the same kind of behavior. They seem to intentionally not get that they're forcing themselves on someone. Their attitude is like, I'm doing you a huge favor offering you my incredible body. You know, and you tell them no thanks, and they don't get it. They still think, well, no thanks doesn't mean no thanks. It means I keep trying. You know, these people, I'm sorry, they're mental cases. That's it.
Now, by the way, in the book itself, I know the tagline of the book, the How to Handle, How to Litigate avoid, handle, and litigate over sexual harassment. I really believe, and I'm not an expert in this, and I've never litigated against anybody for this problem, but it would seem as though if you didn't do it the right way, you could get laughed out of court, quote unquote. You need to know what you're doing before you present this to someone.
Right. Yeah, that's why I wrote the book, because I had three lawsuits and I learned so much about the law and so much about sexual harassment and so much about getting an attorney. I mean, it doesn't have to go that far, but if you do end up needing to go that far, you need somebody to advise you. Believe me, if you don't know what you're doing, you could end up with a lawyer who will not represent you in your best interest. So I wrote a book to tell people what sexual harassment is, in case anyone doesn't know, and how to recognize it if it's happening in your workplace, how to avoid it if you can. If you can't avoid it, how to handle it, what to do if you think you're being sexually harassed, and if you've done everything you think you can do, everything you've done everything right and it's still going on and you choose to litigate, how to find a lawyer who is not going to sell you out, who is going to represent you in your best interest, and what to expect from the lawyer and the law and going to court if it goes there, and how to recover from the aftermath. And there's always an aftermath.
Nance, what's my takeaway for this? I pick the book up, I read it page by page, cover to cover. What do I, Michael Ray, get out of this book that I didn't have before? And by the way, I don't think the book is just for women. This is human beings. So man or woman, what do I take away?
Right. No, you're right. It's not just for women. Women are 98% of the sexual harassment victims. But men get it too. And keep in mind that men have sisters and girlfriends and wives and daughters and mothers in the workplace who are also getting it. So this touches everyone. What you'll get from this book is knowledge, and I absolutely believe knowledge is power in this area. Empowerment is really essential. You don't want to feel helpless. You don't want to feel like a victim. Because, I mean, that can really affect your mindset when you go to work. I mean, you go to work with your stomach churning because you know that, you know, you're likely to experience something unpleasant, you know, today because you have in the past, and it can be really nasty. If you know what your rights are, what the law says, keep in mind that sexual harassment is a crime. You're having a crime committed on you. You know how to handle yourself, know what to do. And all of that is in the book, because I've been through this in every kind of line of work. You started to reel off some that I've done. I've done so many different lines of work, and unfortunately this kind of thing has happened in most of those lines of work. So it's not a book for actresses, it's a book for anybody in the workplace. And knowledge is power, and I give you everything you could need to know about sexual harassment in this book, because I lived it.
Okay, now what's your feedback been for women who have read the book? What's the feedback?
You know, I went to high school with a girl who is now a bigwig, I want to say like assistant attorney general or something in California. And she has been into women's things, and she told me once that she has spoken on this issue herself. She got the book fairly early on when it came out and read it, and she emailed me and said, "You are right on everything. That's exactly what people should do." So I know I was right on. I've been there, and I've been through the lawsuits, and I knew what to do, but it was nice to have her confirm that that I was right on track with all of it.
Oh, sure. One other thing, and it's in your press release, one of the talking points, which I think is really critical, physical and psychological toll. You know, what kind of physical and psychological toll can harassment have on someone?
Oh, you know, you can become so sick. When I used to do General Hospital, I would have to call in for work in the morning. So I would call in, and they would say, "Yeah, you can work tomorrow. Come on in." And as soon as I hung up the phone, I started to feel sick. I would get nauseous. Sometimes I would get an upset stomach. I couldn't sleep that night. When I would wake up the next morning, my hands would shake. I'd have anxiety attacks. I'd headaches. I'd go to the set if I would find out that there were two stage managers. One was a total sweetheart, and the other one was the harasser. If the nice guy, the nice stage manager, was there, then I felt fine, and it was a good day, and I had fun on the set. If the other guy was there, it was paranoia all day long, trying to be very aware of my surroundings to make sure I was never alone with him, anxiety attacks, nervousness, all of that, nausea, until he would say, okay, you're released, and I could go home, and I'd feel fine. I mean, all kinds of symptoms, physical and emotional and psychological symptoms can show up if you're being harassed.
Now, by the way, when these things come up, and you know that it's happening to you, is there anybody that you can go to? Is there a supervisor, someone there within the business itself? Will they even listen to something like that?
Actually, you know, unfortunately, sexual harassment usually happens by your supervisor or someone over you because it's an abuse of power. And so it's not usually a coworker. It's usually someone who has power they can abuse. If you're being sexually harassed by your boss, obviously you can't go to your boss to complain about it. You have to tell them, of course, that you feel like you're being treated badly, or put it in some diplomatic way to make sure you have said stop it. But that it's important that you let them know that it's not acceptable. If it continues, does your boss have a boss? Is it a huge organization or a mom and pop place? You have to go to someone of power, your boss or over their head if you need to. The Employment and Fair Housing exists to take care of cases like this. If it's a small company and you just have a boss and there is no one over their head and you've told them to leave you alone and they're not, go to Fair Employment and Housing. That's what they exist for. They'll investigate the case. You won't have to worry about hiring a lawyer and going to court and all of this. They will ask you questions. They'll interview you. They'll want to know the details. They'll let the harasser know that that his behavior is not acceptable, that it is illegal. They will make sure that anyone in your company knows what sexual harassment is, so that they have no excuse for, oh, gee, I didn't know that was harassment. And then if they choose to take it to court after a fashion, they can fight it for you, or you can hire a lawyer and fight it yourself. But, yeah, there's always someone you can go to.
Nance, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yeah, I have a blog now, actually. It's sexualharassment101.wordpress.com. And my book is up on booklocker.com. It's under www.booklocker.com/books/4397.html. Or just look it up under my name, Nance, N-A-N-C-E, Perry, P as in Peter, A-R-R-Y. Or look up sexual harassment in their little search box up there, and mine is the longest title, How to Avoid, Handle, Litigate Over Sexual Harassment.
Hey, Nance, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been good having you on.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Good night.
I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Again. And the evening were new again. I would spend it with you. But now the curtain falls.